Malone silently translated. The devil's bones. It took another year to find a tribe that knew about it. I embedded myself in their village, apprenticed myself to the shaman. Eventually, he took me to a set of ruins buried in the upper Amazon basin, revealing a vast complex of temple foundations that stretched for miles. The shaman told me that tens of thousands of people had once lived there, a vast, unrecorded civilization. Malone had heard of similar ruins, identified via satellite imaging, found deep in the hinterlands of the Amazon, where people thought no one lived. Each discovery defied the conventional wisdom that deemed the rainforest incapable of supporting civilization. Estimates put the number living there at over 60,000. The fate of those people remained unknown, though it was theorized starvation and disease were the main culprits of their demise. But maybe there was another explanation. The searchers across the dining hall checked the last of the bodies. The two armed men closest to them alternated their attention from their colleagues to their captives. Among the ruins, I found piles of bones, many of them burned. Other bodies looked like they died where they dropped. The shaman told me the story of a great plague that killed in seconds and wilted flesh from bones. He showed me an unusual dark orchid growing nearby. I didn't know then if the orchid was the source of the plague, but the shaman claimed the plant was death itself. Even to touch it could kill. The shaman taught me how to gather it safely and how to wring the poison from its petals. And once you learned how to gather this toxin? Trask finally glanced at him. I had to test it, of course. First on the shaman, then on his village. Malone's blood went cold at the matter-of-fact admission of mass murder. Trask turned back. Afterward, to ensure I had the only source, I burned all the pockets of the orchids I could find. So, you see, my rescuer, I hold the key to it all. He'd heard enough. Stick to my side, he mouthed. He eased toward the edge of the crowd, towing Trask in his wake. Once there, he knew he had to incapacitate the four armed men as quickly as possible. There'd only be a few seconds of indecision. The men were finally gathered in a group. Seven rounds remained in his gun's magazine. Not much room for error. He eyed an overturned table with a marble top that should offer decent cover, but he needed to be away from the civilians before the shooting started. He gripped Trask by the elbow and motioned to the table. Come with me, on my mark. He did a fast three count, then sprinted toward the table, swinging his gun into view, only to have the floor beneath his feet jolt, throwing him high. He flew past the table, crashing hard, losing his grip on the gun, which skittered across the floor out of reach. He rolled to see the front of the dining hall tear away, glass exploding, the walls splintering open. Dark jungle burst inside. Then he realized the boat had hit shore and run aground. Everybody had been knocked off their feet, even the gunman. He searched for Trask, but the botanist had been tossed into the assault team. Trask straightened up, and even the blood gushing from a broken nose failed to hide his features. Surprised voices erupted from the four gunmen. Rifles were pointed, and Trask lifted his arms in surrender. Malone searched for the pistol, but it was gone. Trask glanced in his direction, the fear and plea plain on his face. The man's thoughts clear. Help me, or else. Malone shook his head and brought a finger to his lips, signaling silence, the hope being that the doctor would realize selling him out was not a good idea. One of them had to be free to act. Trask hesitated, was jerked to his feet, but said nothing. A parrot screamed across the ruins of the dining hall, cawing, seemingly voicing Malone's frustration. And he could only stare as Trask and his captors vanished into the dark bower of the jungle. Pierce stared across the ruins of the dining hall, studying what lay beyond a gash in the walls. So you lost him. Not much I could do, Malone said, on his knees, searching among a tumble of chairs and tossed tables. Especially after the boat ran aground. Trask's cabin had come up empty, but Pierce now knew that the doctor had the sample hidden on him. He'd also listened as Malone reported everything else Trask had said. Malone reached under a tablecloth and came up with the pistol he'd lost earlier. A lot of good it does me now. What's our next move? You don't have to stay on this. You're retired. Go back to your lady in Buenos Aires. I wish I could, but Stephanie Nell would have my ass. I'm afraid you're stuck with me. I'll try, though, not to get in the way. He caught the sarcasm. So far, this brief partnership between justice and defense had proved fruitless. But with Trask on the run and captured by a guerrilla force, as much as he hated to admit it, Pierce could use the help. Malone picked his way across the dining hall to the demolished wall of the ship. Pierce watched as the former agent bent down and examined something. All of the passengers were gone, being offloaded to other boats. Got a blood trail here that leads outside. He hustled over. Has to be Trask, Malone said. He broke his nose when the ship crashed. It was bleeding badly. Then we follow it. I saw a patrol boat earlier. They could have offloaded him by the river. I spotted that craft, too, from the cabin, but it took off shortly after we went aground. The attack, the fire, the crash, it's drawn lots of river traffic. You think the ground team and the boat are planning a rendezvous farther along the Amazon, where there are fewer eyes to see them? It makes sense, and that gives us a window of opportunity. A small one, which is shrinking fast. Malone pointed to the drops of blood scuffed by the boot of one of the gorillas. Once in the jungle, it'll be hard to track in the dark. But they're in a hurry, Pierce said, not expecting anyone to follow, and they'll have to stay close to the riverbank waiting for their ride. With four men and a prisoner in tow, they should leave an easy trail. Which proved true. Minutes later, slogging across the muddy bank, Pierce saw that it wasn't difficult to spot where the gorillas had pushed into the forest. He glanced back at the beached riverboat, its bulk angled in the river, the stern still billowing black smoke into the twilight sky. Other watercraft had now come to its rescue. Passengers were being ferried away as the fires aboard spread. He turned from the smoking ruins of the MV Fawcett. The boat had surely been named after the doomed British explorer Percy Fawcett, who vanished in the Amazon searching for a mythical lost city. Pierce faced the jungle, hoping the same fate didn't await them. Let's go, he said, leading the way. Less than 10 feet into the dense vegetation, the forest snuffed what little light remained. Night shrouded them. He limited any illumination to a single penlight, which he shone ahead, picking out boot prints in the muddy mulch and broken stems on the bushes. The trail was easy to track, but hard to traverse. Every vine was armed with thorns. Branches hung low. Thickets were as convoluted as woven steel. They forged onward, moving as quietly as possible. A growing ruckus from the night helped mask their advance. All around them were screams, buzzes, howls, and croaking. The shine of his tiny light also caught eyes staring back at them. Monkeys huddled in trees, parrots nesting atop branches, a pair of larger pupils, like yellow marbles with black dots, glowed. Maybe a jaguar or a panther. About 40 minutes of careful advancing, Malone whispered, "To the left. Is that a fire?" Pierce stopped and shaded his penlight with his palm. In the blackness, he spotted a flickering crimson glow through the trees. "They made camp?" Malone whispered. "Maybe waiting for full night before making a break for the river in their boat. If it's them at all, only one way to find out." He flicked his flashlight off and continued toward the glow, noting that the path they were following led in that direction, too. 20 minutes of careful plodding were needed to close the distance. They halted in a copse of vine-laden trees that offered cover and a vantage point to spy upon the camp. Pierce surveyed the clearing. Mud and thatch huts indicated a native village. He spotted a clutch of children and a handful of men and women, including a wizened elder who cradled an injured arm. All were held at gunpoint by one of the gorillas from the boat. The campfire must have attracted their attention, too. He spotted Trask on his knees by the flames. One of the gorillas leaned over him, clearly shouting, but the words could not be heard. Trask shook his head, then was backhanded for his stubbornness, sending the doctor sprawling across the ground. Another of the assailants came forward, balancing a small metal case on his open palm. His captors must have searched Trask and found the vials. The faint glow of LED lights could be seen on the case.
"Locked with an electronic code," Malone said.
He agreed, "which they're trying to learn from Trask. And I can tell you from our little bit of conversation, he's going to drive a hard bargain."
Pierce counted 4 gorillas, each heavily armed. The odds weren't good, 2-1, and any firefight risked harming or killing the villagers. A new group of gorillas appeared at the village's western edge, filing out of a worn trail that likely led to the river. They numbered another 6, along with a 7th, who stood taller than the others and unwrapped the black cloth from his face. A deep scar ran down his left cheek, splitting his chin. He barked out orders that were instantly obeyed. This one was in charge. 2-1 odds just became 5-1. The newcomers were also heavily armed with assault rifles, grenade launchers, and shotguns. Pierce realized the futility of their situation. But Malone seemed unaffected.
"We can do this."
Malone watched as the assault force leader yanked Trask to his feet and pointed west, toward the river, where the boat was likely waiting.
"We can't let them get to the water," he said. "Once they've cleared the village, we can use the jungle to our advantage."
"Guerrilla warfare against guerrillas."
Pierce shrugged.
"I like it. They teach you that in law school?"
"The Navy."
Pierce smiled. "With any luck, maybe in the confusion we can grab Trask and the vials."
"I'll settle for the vials."
Their targets left the village. They kept low, running parallel. Interesting how their quarry was making no effort to move quietly. Orders were barked in loud voices, the crunch of boots and snap of branches announcing a retreat toward the river. The entourage moved as if in total command of their surroundings, which, in a sense, they were. This was home field for them. But that didn't mean the visiting team couldn't score a few points every once in a while. They neared the village clearing, and Malone noted 2 of the gunmen had remained behind, assault rifles still trained on villagers. A problem. It seemed they intended to leave no witnesses. He caught Pierce's attention, pantomimed what they should do, and received a nod of acknowledgement. They closed the last of the distance at a run, bursting into the clearing, appearing in an instant behind the 2 gunmen. A shot to the chest and he dropped 1. Pierce killed the other. The pistol blasts were loud, echoing into the forest. Malone skidded on his knees and caught the assault rifle as his target collapsed. Pointing it toward the sky, he strafed a fierce blast at the stars. He hoped the initial pistol shots accompanied by the rifle fire would be taken by the retreating guerrillas as the village's bloody cleanup. Pierce motioned for the locals to stay calm and not spoil the ruse. The elder nodded, seeming to understand, and waved the others down, ensuring that mothers kept frightened children quiet, signaling the men to gather what they could in preparation to flee. Pierce holstered his Sig Sauer and gripped one of the guerrillas' rifles. Malone followed his example. He spotted a grenade launcher resting on the ground near one of the bodies. He considered taking it, too, but it would likely only burden him in the confines of the jungle. The rifle and his pistol would have to do. They fled toward the trail taken by the gorillas. 30 yards in, the shadowy form of a gorilla blocked their path. Someone must have been sent back to make sure the village was secure. Before they could react, the man opened fire, shredding leaves and sending them diving into the vegetation. Malone rolled behind the bole of a tree and twisted in time to see the muzzle flash of Pierce's return fire.
"Not bad. Fast response."
The gorilla was thrown backward, his chest blown out as bullets tore into flesh. The body thudded to the ground.
"Keep going," Pierce said. "Let's try to stay on their flanks."
Malone bit back a groan of complaint from his sore knees. Jungle warfare was definitely a younger man's game. But he could handle it. They plunged ahead. Pierce kept track of Malone's progress, matching the pace. What they needed was for any boat waiting for the group to be out of commission. Unfortunately, they were a little short-handed and would have to handle the situation once there. He continued through the forest, paralleling the path taken by the guerrilla force. He on one side of the trail, Malone on the other, out of sight. A slight wind coursed through the trees. Its direction appeared away from the river, inland. Shouts from ahead brought him to a stop, first in Portuguese, then English.
"Show yourself or I kill your man."
He edged forward and crouched low.
A deadfall opened ahead where one of the canopy trees had recently fallen, tearing a hole in the forest. Starlight bathed the open wound, revealing the guerrilla leader. He held aloft the small steel case, its LED display still glowing. Another of the guerrillas nestled the muzzle of an assault rifle to the back of Trask's skull. Pierce cared nothing for the doctor's life. Malone had shared what he'd learned as to how Trask had obtained his prize and at what cost. All that mattered was securing the toxin before it escaped to some foreign enemy's manufacturing lab, where it could be mass-produced.
"Come out now or I kill him," the leader shouted.
From the edge of the deadfall, another pair of gunmen appeared. Only then did Pierce realize his mistake. "Your man." Prodded at gunpoint, a second prisoner was thrust into view, gagged, his face bloody. Malone. Malone kept his fingers folded atop his head. He'd been ambushed shortly after parting company with Pierce. A shadow had loomed behind him, clamping a hand over his mouth, an arm around his throat. Then a second figure slammed the butt of a rifle into his gut, dropping him to the ground. Dazed, he'd been gagged with one of their face scarves and thrust forward at gunpoint. He now stared out at the dark forest, willing Pierce not to show himself. Unfortunately, his silent plea was not answered. 20 yards away, Pierce appeared, rifle high over his head, surrendering. One of his captors shoved Malone forward. Pierce caught his gaze as he staggered near and mouthed, "Be ready to run." Pierce stepped past Malone and shouted, "I surrender," which gained the guerrilla leader's full attention. He tossed the assault rifle away. As expected, all eyes followed the weapon's trajectory across the deadfall. He quickly dropped an arm to his waist, yanked out his Sig Sauer, and shot from the hip, taking out the two closest gunmen. Now for the real prize. He aimed at the leader and fired. Instead of a clean kill, though, the round found the man's outstretched hand smacking into the steel case, then penetrating the chest. A yellowish mist burst instantly outward, swamping those nearby. He remembered Malone's relating the botanist's warning, "If even a single vial breaks, it'll kill anything within 100 yards. The danger spread. Screaming began. He backpedaled as the breeze caught the cloud and blew it toward him. Malone, still gagged, didn't have to be told twice and bolted for the trailhead. Pierce turned to follow, only to see a figure emerge from the toxic cloud. Trask. His face appeared parboiled, eyes weeping and blind. Another few steps and a convulsion jackknifed through every muscle, throwing the body off balance into the ground. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Pierce turned and sprinted after Malone. The wind-blown danger rolled after him. He glanced back at the spreading devastation. Monkeys fell from tree limbs. Birds took flight only to cartwheel to the ground. Anything that crawled, slithered, or flew seemed to instantly succumb. He caught up with Malone, and together they fled down the last of the trail and burst into the village clearing, which, unfortunately, wasn't empty. The locals were still there, having not yet evacuated. Children darted behind mothers' legs, frightened by their sudden reappearance, thinking perhaps the guerrillas had returned. Matters weren't helped by the fact that Malone was bloody and gagged. Pierce drew to a halt and swung around to face the trail. Above the canopy, a flurry of bats spun and darted, beginning their nightly forage for insects. Then they began to drop from the sky, at first farther out, then closer in. Death swept toward them, carried by the wind. He turned to the villagers and saw frightened faces. None of them, himself included, would ever be able to run fast enough to escape the cloud. His errant shot had doomed them all. Malone searched for their only hope, again skidding to his knees and snatching up the RPG launcher. A quick check confirmed the weapon was loaded. Thank God.
"What are you doing?" Pierce yelled.
No time to explain. He hoisted the tube to his shoulder, aimed for the trailhead, and fired. The weapon jolted against his face, spitting out smoke behind him. A grenade whistled in a tight arc, then blasted down the throat of the trail. A fiery explosion lit the night. Trees erupted in a smoldering rain of limbs and leaves. Heat washed over him. Was it enough? Trask's words echoed in his head. "There's no stopping it short of incineration." He tugged the gag free. Fire spread outward from the blast site. Flames danced high into the night. Smoke billowed upward, masking the stars, consuming all of the air around it, which hopefully included the toxin. He held his breath. Not that it would save him if the cloud reached here. Then, from the edge of the forest, a dark shape burst into view, a shred of a living shadow. A panther. Yellowed claws dug deep into the dirt. Dark eyes reflected from the campfire's glow. The big cat hissed, showing fangs, then burst to the side, diving back into the dark bower. Alive. A good omen. He waited another minute, then another. Death never came. Pierce joined him, patting his shoulder. "Nice tag team on that one. And damn quick thinking, old man." He lowered the weapon. "Who you calling old?"
Lee Child versus Joseph Fender. When Joseph Fender decided to try a series character, he took many cues from Lee Child's Jack Reacher. Joe named his hero Nick Heller and made him not a private eye, but a private spy. Nick works for politicians and governments and corporations, sometimes digging up secrets they'd rather keep buried. Like Jack Reacher, though, Nick's sense of justice drives him. He's a mix of blue-collar and white-collar, the son of a notorious Wall Street criminal, raised in immense wealth that evaporated when his father went to prison. He spent his formative years in a split-level ranch house in a working-class suburb of Boston. By nature, Nick's a chameleon. He can blend in among the corporate elite as easily as he does among the jarheads. And of course, he roots for the Boston Red Sox. Jack Reacher, on the other hand, is a Yankees fan. His background is vastly different from Nick's, but equally scattered. Reacher is an army brat, raised on military bases around the world, a man without a country, but still an American. He's a loner who avoids attachments, yet he's absolutely loyal. He suffers no fools. Nick Heller and Jack Reacher, chalk and cheese, as the Brits say, couldn't be more different, yet so much the same. Which can also be said for the two writers. Lee and Joe are good friends. They share a love of writing, baseball, and the quest for America's best hamburger. Not a gourmet burger, just the best, plain, honest, normal burger. Lee tells a story of some years ago when they were trying a contender in a Spanish restaurant, yeah, go figure, on 22nd Street in New York. The talk turned to upcoming projects, and Joe started riffing, thinking out loud about maybe starting a series character. He gave Lee a lengthy and penetrating analysis that covered every cost and benefit, every desirable and undesirable characteristic, every strength and weakness. "I wish I had a voice recorder running. I could have sold the transcript to Writer's Digest. It would have become the Rosetta Stone for all such decisions," Lee recalls. Eventually, Joe followed through on his analysis with the first Nick Heller story, Vanished, 2009. Written with his trademark blend of freewheeling imagination mixed with iron self-discipline. Lee is not a planner. He does not outline stories. They just emerge naturally. For Joe, that's like walking on a wire without a net. So Lee came up with the premise of two guys in a bar in Boston. Reacher would be the out-of-towner, like always. Heller would be home in the city he loves. Lee was taken by the notion of a mirror at the back of a bar, the way you can look at the reflection of the person next to you and talk with both intimacy and distance. Heller and Reacher would both end up talking to and about and around someone who's in trouble. Eventually, they'd help the guy out, because that's what they do. But that help would come in vastly different ways. The story was written long distance. Lee sent the first chunk by email, and Joe immediately asked, "What do you see happening next?" In typical Lee Child fashion, he answered, "No idea until you've written it." Joe coped with such improvisation just fine. Actually, their biggest problem was who would win the Yankees-Sox game that kicks the whole thing off.
Good and valuable consideration. The bar was 100 years old, built for an ink-stained subset of the working class. Clerks, scriveners, printers, and other office-bound wretches of every kind who had once filled the narrow streets as they quit at the ends of long days and poor conditions, seeking solace wherever they could find it. Now it was just another Boston curiosity, full of dim light and glazed oatmeal-colored tile and brass and mahogany, most notably on the bar itself, where a length of tight-grained wood from a massive old tree had been polished to an impossible shine by a million sleeves. The only discordant decorative note was high on the bar back itself, but it was also the only reason Reacher was there. A big flat-screen television, tuned to a live broadcast of the Yankees at Fenway Park. Reacher paused inside the door and tried to pick his spot. His eyesight was pretty good, so he didn't need to be close, but in his experience, flat screens weren't great when viewed at an angle, so he wanted to be central. Which gave him just one practical choice. A lone, unoccupied stool among five in the middle section of the bar, which was more or less directly face-on to the screen. If it had been a theater seat, it would have been expensive. Front row, center. There was a dark-haired woman on its left, her back to the room, and a fat guy on its right. And then came a lean guy with short hair and muscles in his neck and his back, and on the right-hand end of the section was another woman, a blonde, with her high heels hooked over the rail of her stool. The lizard part of Reacher's brain told him immediately the only one to either worry about or rely on was the guy with the short hair and the muscles. Not that Reacher was expecting trouble, even though he was in Boston, rooting for the Yankees. The bar back was mirrored behind a thicket of bottles, and Reacher saw the short-haired guy spot him, just a blink of roving vigilance, automatic, which reinforced the message his lizard brain had sent. Not a cop, he thought, but some kind of a lone wolf tough guy, very relaxed, very sure of himself. Ex-military, possibly, from the kind of shadowy unit that taught you to glance in mirrors from time to time, or suffer the consequences. Then the fat guy on the right of the empty stool looked in the mirror, too, much more obviously. He was not relaxed. He was not sure of himself. He kept his eyes on Reacher's reflected image all the way through the trip from the door to the empty stool. Reacher slid in beside him and rocked from side to side to claim his space, and he put his elbows on the mahogany, and the fat guy half turned with a hesitant but expectant look, as if unsure whether to speak or wait to be spoken to. Reacher said nothing. He rarely offered greetings to strangers. He liked to keep to himself. Eventually, the guy turned away again, but he kept his gaze on the mirror, not the screen. He had a prominent lower lip, sticking out like a pout, and then a great wattle of flesh fell away in a perfect parabola to his shirt collar, uninterrupted by any kind of bony structure. The pneumatic impression continued all the way to his dainty feet. The guy was like a balloon made of flesh-colored silk. He looked like he would be soft and dry to the touch. He had a wedding band on his left hand, deep in the fat, like a sausage with a tourniquet. He was wearing a suit made of the same material as chino pants. The waistband could have been 60 inches. Reacher looked up at the game. The top of the first was over, no hits, no runs, one man left on base. The commercials were starting, first up being a leasing offer on a brand of automobile Reacher had never heard of. The barman finished up elsewhere and scooted over sideways, and Reacher asked for a full fat bud in a bottle, which he got seconds later, ice cold and foaming. The fat guy said, "I'm Jerry DeLong." At first, Reacher wasn't sure who he'd been addressing, but by a process of elimination, he figured it was him. He said, "Are you?" The guy with the short hair and the muscles was watching the exchange in the mirror. Reacher glanced at his reflection, and then the fat guy's, who looked straight at him via the glass. Barroom intimacy. Eye contact, but indirect. Reacher said, "I'm here to watch the game," which seemed to satisfy the guy. He looked away as if an issue had been settled. His gaze returned to the mirror. The various angles of incidence and reflection were hard to calculate, but Reacher figured the guy was watching the door behind him. He was giving off a low-level buzz of anxiety. His eyes were pale and watery, but the rest of him was composed. His huge, pale face was immobile, and his body was still. The commercials ended, and the broadcast returned to Fenway. The little green bandbox looked luscious under the lights. The Yankees were in the field, in road gray. Their pitcher was throwing the last of his warm-ups. He didn't look very good. Nick Heller had entered the bar 3 minutes earlier and had immediately picked up on the after-work vibe, the frenzied high spirits, the smell of sweat and cologne and beer and unwinding anxiety. It was like walking into a party at its very peak, the disorienting cacophony of chatter, the nearly deafening babble, the whooping laughter. It was one of Heller's favorite hometown bars because it was the real thing. You'd never find raspberry wheat craft beer here. They had Narragansett beer on tap, a beer that Bostonians were loyal to even if it was watery swill. There were a couple of available seats at the bar on either side of a great fat man. Interesting. Heller wondered whether the fat guy was saving them for friends. He couldn't be from the neighborhood. No one who came here did things like saving seats. Heller sidled through the crowd toward the bar counter. One of the things he liked about this place was the mirror behind the serried ranks of bottles. A mirror like this, you could see the faces of those sitting at the bar as you approached. Or you could sit at the bar, back to the room, and see who was coming up from behind. You could talk to the guy or the woman next to you and be looking him or her in the face. In the mirror. Directly, but at the same time, indirectly. Heller liked being able to relax when he went for a drink, and you never knew who might turn up. As he neared the bar, he noticed one face in the mirror looking at him, the fat guy. He had an odd face, a receding chin with a cow-like wattle that tucked under his collar like an apron. He reminded Heller of a trout. He was watching Heller intently, like he'd been waiting for him. Heller had never seen the guy before, but still the fat man studied him, as if, well, as if he were expecting someone but didn't know what that person might look like. As if Heller might be that guy. Strange. Heller didn't know him. Heller sat on the stool and nodded at the man. "How you doing?" the guy said. "Hey," Heller said, neither friendly nor rude. A pause. "Jerry DeLong," the man said, sticking out his hand. Heller didn't feel like making friends. He didn't want to chat. The Red Sox were playing the Yankees at Fenway Park. This was a major moment in Boston sports, a rite, like the gladiator games at the Roman Colosseum back in the day. And there was no better place to watch an important game like this than here. After a brief pause, Heller shook his hand. "Nick," he said. No last name. Heller didn't like to give out his name. He immediately turned to the huge flat TV screen set to the Sox. Of course it was. The owner of the bar, a buddy of Nick's, was an ardent Sox fan. So was Sully, the bartender. Some nights, though, there was discord in the bar when the Sox were playing opposite the Bruins. Bostonians also loved their hockey. You even had nights when all four Boston teams, the Sox, the Bruins, the Celtics, and the Patriots, were playing on four different channels. You didn't want to be in this particular bar on a night like that. It got ugly. "Nick," the bartender said, pulling him a Budweiser without asking. "Sully," Heller said. "Big night, huh?"
Romp to victory.
Absolutely, said Sully, setting the glass of beer in front of him, a foamy white head like a layer of cotton batting.
He wagged his head as if to say, from your mouth to God's ear.
Then Heller sensed in his peripheral field the fat guy staring at him again. In a neutral voice, Heller said, do I know you? The guy sipped a gin and tonic.
You here to meet someone? He said.
I'm here to watch the Sox win, Heller said.
A degree friendlier this time, but still no nonsense.
Sorry.
It's cool, Heller relented.
In the bar back mirror, he noticed a large man approaching the empty seat on DeLong's left. Heller knew at once this was someone to keep a wary eye on. He was huge, way taller than most, easily 6'5", and at least 250 pounds. Unusually broad-shouldered, a tank. He was all muscle and had that ex-military look you couldn't miss. The thrift shop clothes and brutalist haircut made him look a little like a drifter, or at least not someone who paid more than 10 bucks at the barbershop. But there was also a canny intelligence in the eyes and a wariness. He had the confident look of someone who wasn't challenged physically very often, and when he was, usually won. He intimidated people and didn't mind it. So this was who Jerry DeLong was meeting. That was a relief. Heller wasn't going to have to fend off some blabomaniac during the ball game. Then he overheard Jerry DeLong introduce himself to the big guy and meet with the same puzzled reaction he'd got from Nick. Heller put his elbow on the mahogany bar next to an ugly cigarette burn from the good old days when you could smoke in bars and took a sip of the beer. It was crisp and cold. He never understood why the Brits liked beer at room temperature. The Yankee pitcher was throwing the last of his warm-ups. He was dismayingly good, graceful and a great arm, a knuckleballer. He had a mean slider and a nasty power changeup with serious depth and fade. Most important, he wasn't wasting his stuff. He was saving it for the game. This wasn't a pitcher who'd burn out long before 100 pitches, like so many others did. Of course he was good. He'd been one of the Red Sox's best starters until the Yankees hired him away for money no one could turn down. The best pitching money can buy. Yankee fans used to boo him relentlessly when the Sox came to Yankee Stadium, but as soon as he started pitching no-hitters for them, they switched allegiances. Heller wasn't a guy who switched allegiances. The bottom of the first started, and the Red Sox batter stepped up to the plate and hit a smash off the first pitch. A home run. It sailed over the green monster, that ridiculously high left field wall that had turned many a surefire homer into a double. The ball probably broke a store window somewhere over on Lansdowne Street. The bar erupted in cheers, predictably. Then Heller noticed three interesting things. Jerry DeLong hadn't been paying attention to the game. He turned to the set searchingly, a beat too late, trying to figure out what had just happened. And the big bruiser on his left wasn't cheering, not even smiling. He'd been watching the game closely, but obviously wasn't a Sox fan. He winced at the home run and made a little snort. He didn't look happy. A New Yorker, then. A Yankees fan. It took a fair measure of chutzpah for a Yankees fan to watch a Sox-Yankees game in a bar like this one. Either that or not caring what other people thought. The latter, Heller decided. Then the fat guy's cell phone rang, and he took it out of his pocket and held it up to his ear, next to the pouch of flesh below his jowls. He cupped his other hand around the phone, shielding it from the clamor of the bar.
Hey, honey, he said, easy and familiar, but also a little panicked, like husbands in bars everywhere. No, not at all. I'm watching the game with Howie and Ken.
Which was the third interesting thing. The fat man was lying to his wife.
Men lie to their wives for a long list of reasons, infidelity being right at the top. But this was no Craigslist assignation. He wasn't here for sex. He didn't have that freshly scrubbed look of a guy on the make. He hadn't combed his hair or splashed on fresh cologne. He looked scared.
Reacher's first name was Jack, and he was pretty damn sure the guy with the muscles wasn't called either Howie or Ken. He could have been born with either moniker, obviously, but he would have abandoned it fast in favor of something harder if he wanted to survive the kind of world he evidently had. Which meant the fat guy was lying through his teeth. He wasn't watching the game with Howie and Ken. In fact, he wasn't watching the game at all. When the lucky fly ball had left the tiny bandbox, the guy had been a long beat behind. He had looked up with a blank expression because of the sudden noise. He was watching the mirror. He was watching the door. He was expecting someone he didn't know by sight. Hence the half-expectant welcome a minute earlier. "Jerry DeLong," the guy had said, as if it might mean something. Reacher snaked a long arm behind DeLong's immense back and poked the guy with the muscles in the shoulder. The guy leaned back but kept his eyes on the game, as did Reacher. The guy in the two-hole for the Sox swung and missed. Strike three. Better. Reacher said, "Who got here first, you or him?" The guy said, "Him." "Did you get the same thing I got?" "Identical." "Was he saving the seats?" "I doubt it." "So now he's expecting a tap on the shoulder, and then they'll go somewhere to do their business?" "That's how I see it." The third batter for the Sox stepped up. Reacher said, "What kind of business? Am I in the kind of place I don't want to be?" "You from New York?" "Not exactly. But you're rooting for them. No crime in being a sane human being." "This place is okay. I don't know what the tub of lard wants." Reacher said, "You could ask him." "Or you could." "I'm not very interested." "Me either. But he's worried about something." The third Sox batter popped up, way high in the infield. Comfortable for the Yankees' second baseman. The guy with the muscles said, "You got a name?" Reacher said, "Everyone's got a name." "What is it?" "Reacher." "I'm Heller." The guy offered his left fist. Reacher bumped it with his right behind DeLong's back. Not the first time his knuckles had touched a Sox fan, but by far the gentlest. The Sox cleanup hitter grounded weakly back to the pitcher, and the inning was over. One zip, Boston. Bad, but not a humiliating disaster. Yet. Reacher said, "If we keep on talking about him like this, eventually he might clue us in." Heller said, "Why would he? He's in trouble." "What are you, Santa Claus?" "I don't like our pitching. I'm looking for a diversion." "Suck it up. Like you did for 100 years? At that point, the bar was quiet. Just the natural ebb and flow, but the barman heard what Reacher said, and he stared hard. Reacher said, "What?" Heller said, "It's okay, Sully." And then Jerry DeLong looked left, looked right, and said, "I'm waiting for someone to break my legs." Heller gave Reacher a glance. Reacher seemed to have an intuition about the fat guy. He knew something was off somehow. Something was wrong. Funny, Heller had the same sort of intuition. Same way he realized pretty quickly that this Reacher guy was really sharp. The fat man had blurted it out. He was genuinely terrified. But then he said no more. The top of the second started. 2 balls, a strike, ball 3. The Boston pitcher stared in. He didn't want to give up a leadoff walk. "Change up coming," Reacher said, "right down the pike." The Yankee batter knew it. He smiled like a wolf. Not a changeup, a full-on fastball. The batter swung as the ball hit the catcher's glove. Reacher looked away. He said, "Maybe this guy'll tell us what's going on, with his legs and all." "You think?" Heller replied. "Or not," Reacher said. "Not unless I want my arms broken too," the fat man said. Full count, and another fastball. Another whiff. 1 down. Heller gave the fat guy a searching look. "Haven't seen you here before, have I?"
"I haven't been here before, no."
"But you're from here." "From here. Very Boston. Bostonians always want to know if you're one of them or not. You can't always tell from the accent, but there's the language. Do you drink soda or tonic? Is something a pissa? Do you go to a liquor store or a packy? Take a U-turn or bang a Yui? They're expert at sussing out fakes and posers. Heller was born outside New York but moved as a teenager to a town north of Boston called Melrose, a working-class place. Heller's father went to prison, and his mother was left with nothing, so Heller could sound Boston if and when he wanted, or not. And this guy DeLong was definitely from around here. DeLong shrugged. Yeah. You work around here? DeLong shrugged again. Government center. Don't like the Irish pub right there? Well, my office is on Cambridge Street. DeLong was stingy with the information. For some reason, he didn't want to talk about what he did or where he worked, which was, for Heller, like a blinking neon arrow. That meant he did something sensitive or classified or unpleasant. But he had the look of a bureaucrat, a government functionary, and Heller took a guess. The good old Saltonstall building, one of the office towers in the bleak ghetto of big government buildings at the foot of Beacon Hill. How's the asbestos? The Saltonstall building, which held an assortment of state bureaucracies, had been abandoned after it was found to be contaminated with asbestos. They did some renovation and dragged the office workers back in, and some of them were mad as a wasp's nest that's been kicked. Yeah, that's gone. Heller smiled. A state worker for sure. He thought of maps of America where the states are resized by population and Rhode Island is twice the size of Wyoming. If you did a map of state employees in the Saltonstall building, the biggest state would be the Department of Revenue. So you're a tax man? Something like that, DeLong said. He didn't look happy about it, like he was being put down somehow. But at the same time, he didn't seem to want to say more. One of those forensic accountant types, aren't you? DeLong looked away uneasily, which just confirmed Heller's theory. What do you say, Reacher? Heller said, reaching around DeLong and bumping Reacher's shoulder. Someone's trying to dodge an audit by some direct means, wouldn't you say? Sounds like it, Reacher said. Wonder how often that works. Jerry DeLong said, It's not going to work this time. He sounded like he was trying to be brave, but without much success. Huh, Heller said, looking into the mirror behind the bar. He saw a blinged-out guy sitting by himself at a small table near the front. Tinted sunglasses, necklaces, and rings. A curious upright posture. The chief enforcer for the Albanian gang in Boston, Alec Dushku. Alley Boy, as he was called, was known for all sorts of colorful executions, including strangling an old man with a shoelace until his eyes popped out of his head. On the table in front of him was a grocery sack, bulky with something. Heller said, You're meeting Alley Boy? Jerry DeLong looked in the mirror and his face paled. He said, Is that him? Sure is, Heller gestured with his head straight at the guy. No time like the present. DeLong said nothing. Reacher said, What's in the grocery sack? DeLong said, Money, $100,000. What for? Me. So what is this, a bribe or a threat? Both. He's going to break your legs and then give you $100,000? Maybe the money first. Why? DeLong didn't answer. Heller said, It's an Albanian thing. One of them read a law book. They like to give good and valuable consideration. They think it cements the deal. And legs heal. Money never goes away. It's either in your house or your bank. It means you're theirs forever. Reacher said, I never heard of that before. You're not from here. Ethical gangsters? Not really. Like I said, legs heal. But it's definitely a two-part deal. All part of the culture. The top of the second ended with a limp swing and miss, strike three. Still 1-0 Boston. The zip didn't look likely to change. The one did. Reacher turned to the fat guy and said, He's supposed to make contact with you, right? DeLong nodded, yes. When? I'm not sure. Soon, I guess. I don't really know what he's waiting for. Maybe he's watching the game. He isn't, Heller said. Not as dumb as he looks, then. You thinking what I'm thinking? Depends when the audit starts, I guess. Tomorrow morning, DeLong said. And what happens if you're in the orthopedic ward? Someone else does it. Less well. The bottom of the second started. a four-pitch lead-off walk. Hopeless. Reacher rocked back and looked at Heller and said, "Do you live here?" Heller said, "Not in this actual bar. But in town? Shouldn't I? I guess someone has to. You worried about these Albanians? Altogether less hassle if Alley Boy doesn't remember my face. Where did you serve? With General Hood? Did you get out in time?"
"Unscathed."
"Good for you. What were you?" "MPs," Reacher said. "Hood's still in Leavenworth, as far as I know.
Where he belongs."
"You armed, by any chance?"
"No, or I'd have shot you already. When you said 100 years, it was less than 90.
"Is the Albanian guy armed?"
"Probably. A SIG, most likely, in the back of his pants. See how he's sitting?"
"I don't think we can get it done during the commercials. We're going to have to give up half an inning. Top of the next."
Now Boston had two runners on. Reacher said, "I'm not sure our corpulent friend can wait that long."
The fat guy said, "What are you talking about?"
Reacher saw the Albanian moving in the mirror, shifting in his chair, putting his hand on the grocery sack. Heller said, "Now."
Reacher turned back to DeLong and said, "Get up right now and walk out straight line, fast. Don't look back and keep on going."
"Out?"
"To the street, right now."
"Which way?"
"Turn left. If in doubt, always turn left. That's a rule that will serve you well."
"Left?"
"Or right. It really doesn't matter. Fast as you can."
Which wasn't lightning quick, but it was reasonably speedy.
The guy swiveled and kind of fell forward off his stool and waited while his fat bounced and jiggled and settled, and then he set off through the crowd, surprisingly light on his dainty feet, and he was already past the blinged-out Albanian before the guy really noticed.
Reacher and Heller paused a beat and slid off their stools in turn and made up the third and fourth places in a determined little procession through the throng. First DeLong, then the Albanian with the sack, then Reacher, with Heller right behind him. DeLong had the advantage. He was cruising like a ship. People were scattering in front of him for fear of getting run over. The Albanian guy wasn't getting the same physical deference. From a distance, he wasn't imposing. Reacher and Heller didn't have that problem. People were stepping smartly aside out of their way. DeLong pushed through the bar door and was gone. The Albanian got there a second later. Reacher and Heller followed him out, practically close enough to touch. The street was quiet and dark and narrow. Old Boston. The fat guy had turned left. His pale bulk was 20 yards away on the sidewalk. The Albanian had seen him. He was getting ready to hustle in pursuit.
"Here?" Reacher asked.
Heller said, "It's as good a place as any." Reacher called, "Alley boy."
The guy missed a step but kept on walking.
"Yes, you, asshole," Reacher said.
The guy glanced back.
"All those rings and chains," Reacher said. "Didn't your mama tell you it's dumb to walk around like that in a poor part of town?"
The guy stopped and turned and said, "What?"
"You could get mugged," Heller said.
The guy said,
"Mugged."
Reacher said, "Where a couple of guys take all your stuff. You don't have that in Albania?"
"You know who I am?"
"Obviously, I just used your name and said you're from Albania. This stuff ain't rocket science."
"You know what will happen to you?"
"Nobody knows what will happen to them. The future's not ours to see. But in this case, I don't suppose much will happen. We might get a couple bucks for the bling. We're certainly not going to wear it. We got more taste."
"Are you kidding me?
Was that a comedy club we were just in?"
There was a dull roar from inside the bar, likely a 3-run homer. Reacher winced. Heller smiled. The Albanian hitched the paper sack higher to the crook of his left elbow, which left his right hand free. Heller stepped forward, going right, and Reacher went left. At that point, the Albanian guy should have turned and run. That was the smart play. He was probably fast enough, but he didn't, inevitably. He was a tough guy. The streets were his. He went for his gun. Which was very dumb because it took both hands out of the game. One was cradling his grocery sack, and the other was snaking around behind his back. Reacher hit him with a straight right, hard, in the center of his face. And after that, it didn't really matter where his hands were. Command and control were temporarily unavailable.
The guy dropped the sack and rocked back on rubber legs, blood already spurting, ready for a standing count, which he didn't get. Street fighting's first rule, there are no rules. Heller kicked him dead on in the nuts, hard enough to take his weight off his feet, and then the guy collapsed down to about half his size in a crouch, and Heller used the flat of his sole to tip him over on his side, and Reacher kicked him in the head, and the guy lay still. Was that hard enough? Heller said. For amnesia, difficult to judge. Amnesia is unpredictable. Best guess? Better safe than sorry. So Heller picked his spot and kicked the guy again, in the left temple, going for lateral displacement of the brain and the pan. Generally 4 times more effective than front to back. No surprise, one of General Hood's boys would have learned stuff like that pretty early. Hood wasn't all bad. Mostly, but not all. In the far distance, Jerry DeLong was watching. Reacher picked up the grocery sack. It was full of $100 bills, all used and wrinkled, held together in bricks by orange rubber bands. Reacher had 4 pants pockets, 2 in front, 2 in back, so he took 4 bricks from the sack and stuffed 1 in each pocket. Then he tore off the gold chains and pulled off the rings and found the cig and went through the Albanian's pockets and dumped out all the loot. He gave the sack to Heller. Heller said, "The cops will come. We don't leave people on the street here, not like New York." Reacher said, "They'll check the bar. Their first stop. I'll go east and you go west. Pleasure working with you." "Likewise," Heller said. They shook hands and melted away into the darkness, opposite directions, leaving the Albanian where he was on the sidewalk, an unfortunate victim of a mugging. His good and valuable consideration stolen before the deal with DeLong could be properly consummated. Therefore, no deal existed. Their own rules said so. DeLong had no obligations and nothing to betray. An Albanian thing, part of the culture. Reacher watched the end of the game in a bar a mile away. He was sure Heller was doing the same thing a mile in the other direction, in which case they were watching 2 different events. Reacher was watching a limp and miserable defeat. Heller was watching a glorious and triumphant victory. But such was life. You can't win them all.
Face Off was edited and introduced by David Baldacci. Dylan Baker read Gaslighted and Infernal Light. Jeremy Bobb read Silent Hunt. Dennis Boutsakaris read Rhymes with Prey, Pit Stop, The Devil's Bones, Good and Valuable Consideration, and Red Eye. Daniel Jarrell read In the Nick of Time. And January Lavoie read The Laughing Buddha and Surfing the Panther. The recording engineers were Mike Ticino, Kevin Mazur, and Noriko Okabe. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Face Off was produced by Carol Shapiro and directed by Mike Noble and Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Face Off is available in print from Simon & Schuster.